Good afternoon, everybody, or good evening, depending upon where you are. It is a treat to welcome Isabel Cañas to our little podcast program here. She's going to be discussing her brand new book, Vampires of El Norte. And what a fabulous cover.
I know. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here on launch day and to collectively admire the beauty that is this
work
cover.
Of art.
The colors are gorgeous. I'm just going to make one comment because people in Arizona are going to complain. Do you see this beautiful cactus here? It is true that it is not native to Texas and the Rio Grande Valley, but correct. It's also true that people have planted them in that area. So it's not completely off the chart for the saguaro to be there. And I'm sad to tell you all that during the heat, many of the saguaro here in Phoenix have collapsed or they've dropped their limbs.
Wow. Very sad.
I know. We have one outside that did that. And so there's some question about, you know, whether one should water them, whether they should put sunscreen around them, sunshade materials around them and the whole bit. But anyway, they're flourishing on this beautiful cover. So that's a really good thing, right?
Absolutely. And Isabel very kindly signed a whole bunch of them. And not sure if you can see that, but I'll put a link in the comments field should you wish to purchase one of our remaining signed copies. And also, if you have questions for Isabel, go ahead and put them in. And I'll stay on for part of the program, but be happy to ask any questions you might have. So, Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. First of all, Isabel, I know it was a huge deal for you to quickly sign our copies before you moved from Seattle further north, where it would have been difficult. So thank you for making that effort.
My pleasure. I was just in Canada for 3 weeks visiting my in-laws. So I'm now back in Seattle for our heat wave, which is probably nothing compared to Arizona.
Okay. Yeah. I thought you'd relocated the way it was all. And I was going to ask you, you seem to be moving steadily north. So
That is the general trajectory. No, the end goal is in a few years to end up on Vancouver Island with my husband's family. But for now, this was just a visit and we're back in Seattle.
Great. The reason I mentioned this is that this is just a little bit of biography for Isabel. She's lived in Mexico, Scotland, Egypt, Turkey, and New York City, which is why I said she keeps moving north. And she is now settled in the Pacific Northwest. She holds a doctorate in Near Eastern languages and civilizations and writes fiction inspired by her own research and her heritage. And I wanted to ask you, because I want to talk about terms for a minute, but how does the doctorate in Near Eastern languages play into your interest in writing writing the Hacienda?
Oh, it doesn't. It doesn't, 100%. It's escapism. I think I turned to the Hacienda because I was writing my PhD dissertation and I needed to do literally anything but write the PhD dissertation, as I think many people who have written dissertations of any length can sympathize with. I wanted escape. I wanted something completely different. And so I ended up with the Hacienda, and then I was writing Vampires of El Norte in between drafting chapters of my dissertation. So it was like I felt very divided doing it. I would spend a few, maybe 2 months writing my dissertation, and then I would switch gears and spend 2 months drafting or writing the next draft of Vampires of El Norte, and then I would switch right back and switch right back. And Barbara, by the end, I was so tired. So then I did the natural thing and got pregnant, you know, for some rest.
Right. Well, there's a dream right there. Talk about speculative fiction. we had the pleasure of talking to Isabel last year about the Hacienda, which she signed for us and which was that first mystery book of the year, our book of the month for us. So there are several terms that have been employed. I've been scrolling through various comments and so forth about this book. And one of them in this biography from the publisher, it talks about speculative fiction. Mm-hmm. Others, including Isabel, have talked about it as a supernatural Western. Patrick sent this to our invitation to watch this to fans of the Mexican Gothic. And I know that there is very large Latin American magical realism school. So Patrick, you're better qualified to discuss all that than I am. I know this isn't a book you've probably had time to read, but
I can't wait to read it.
You'll love it. But what do you understand about Mexican Gothic, for example?
Well, Isabel's probably more qualified than both of us to talk about it.
True.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. It's an interesting. We were talking with various authors about this sort of resurgence of interest in, or the horror genre, for example, and how it has really enjoyed a new rebirth and a kind of a, you know, elements of folklore and different native voices are contributing to the field now. And it's like this real interesting time. You know, you get the Stephen Graham Jones and you get, you know, various other authors who are playing with, indigenous folklore and traditions of various kinds and incorporating that into their work. So I don't know. And then I think of course, Silvia Moreno.
Garcia.
Yeah, you know, she has the book called Mexican Gothic, of course. But I'm interested to kind of, you know, sort of pry apart where what magical realism means as opposed to supernatural fiction. Are these just convenient labels that publishers like to use, or do you think they're different kind of approaches?
I think from a craft perspective, there's certainly different approaches. The literary critics and the book reviewers and the publishers will slap labels on books willy-nilly, depending on what is working for their audiences. But I think from the writer's perspective and from the craft perspective, these are two, I would call them disciplines almost, because magical realism involves a slant of what we might call magic in the realm of the real that the characters in the book simply acknowledge as a part of their world. And so within the realm of magical realism, we can think of the big bad classics like 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez or Isabel Allende's The House of the Spirits. Those are stories in which, like, for example, in 100 Years of Solitude, there's like one moment where blood runs down the street and it goes up a set of steps and into someone's home. And nobody, and then the story continues. And there are hundreds of other examples of that kind of touch of magic that you, I guess you could call it, that permeates the novel. And none of the characters within the novel recognize it as like out of the ordinary. They kind of just roll with it. Whereas with the speculative, or in the case of Vampires of El Norte, the speculative element here is a vampire, a monster creeping around in the dark. The characters, Nena and Nestor, encounter this monster with disbelief. It's a rupturing of the real world, which is why I would categorize it under horror and speculative fiction rather than magical realism. Because as with other aspects of horror or other examples of horror, you're looking at a plot device or a symbol or a creature or even a character who ruptures reality. And the characters in the novel then have to grapple with that. And so there's an acknowledgement that something is off, something is different, something might harm us because it's different. And I think horror and the way that you were, Patrick, you were just talking about how voices from outside of, I guess, like the white and the white male mainstream have been reclaiming horror and playing with it in new ways and incorporating aspects of our own culture into it, is because for so long, what was the rupture in reality or the element of like to be distrusted or to be afraid of? Often, if you look at older examples of horror, it was the other. And so now what we're seeing right now in this incredible renaissance of horror that publishing is experiencing, which I love and want to continue, is the other taking the reins, so to speak.
It's not the Teutonic kind of stranglehold on all the myths, right?
Exactly, exactly. And so I think it's really powerful as a writer and as a reader as well to encounter these works. Like, I loved Mexican Gothic. In fact, when it came out, I love the title. It's so evocative. It's so strong. It's so bold. But I was also like Darn, because that's what I want to name the genre that I write in. When I think of what I am drawn to as an artist, when it comes to, like, I grew up with Dracula. I grew up with the Brontes. This was my bread and butter when I was a kid. And so, but I always felt, you know, a little bit apart from it because there were no characters who looked like me, who looked and talked like my family, who acted like us, who believed in the things that we believed in or drew, or the books did not draw from the folklore and religion that I grew up with. And so the meeting of the Gothic and my Mexican background is what I do. So I would call my genre and my oeuvre, both currently published and future, Mexican Gothic, maybe lowercase g, so as not to confuse it with Silvia Moreno Garcia's work. But yeah, I think picking apart these labels is really fun, especially because Vampires of El Norte, as my publicity team has and marketing team have informed me, crosses a lot of genre barriers and mashes a bunch of genres up. And so, you know, the question was kind of, well, where does this book go? To whom do we sell it? Which I say anyone who likes the Hacienda will probably like this book. But when we're thinking of the bigger world, it's a Western. It has a road trip. It has a classic element of the historical novel, which is like a battle and a war that really happened. And characters who wander in and out of the story who are real political figures living at the time. And let me tell you, tracking them down in historical sources, trying to figure out where they were at certain times was a task I am not sure I understood how difficult it was when I took it on. But it's also a romance. Structurally, it has a happily ever after. And the second chance romance that occurs between Nena and Nestor follows some classic beats that I think romance writers will, that I think will really resonate with romance readers. So, and it has the supernatural element as well, which is a classic element of horror, the vampire, who I reinvent for this specific setting and this specific story. So in terms of genre and labeling, she's a bit of a mess, but we love her.
Well, I think genre bending is a, you know, is a fair description. I mean, in scrolling through, you can see some people emphasize the romance, some people emphasize the historical, some people, you know, like the supernatural part or not quite sure what the vampires are. I mean, I think in part they emphasize colonialism as a real horror, which Grace Lee, who's one of my favorite authors, an Asian American author, mentions in her discussion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm not a fan of labels, but if I have a sort of condensed amount of space to describe the book, you know, in our publications and so forth, you have to sort of grapple with, you know, which ones are going to be key. But one of the reasons I wanted Patrick to do is there are a couple of male, I mean, what do you call Joe Lansdale? If you look at his whole body of work, Patrick, I mean, you know, and even Lauren Estelman, these are white male writers, true, but they have been writing. Joe in particular, I think, is very much a cross genre. He's Texas or Louisiana, really, but I call him
a storyteller.
Yeah, but he has a lot of these elements in
absolutely.
His
he's done everything. Yeah, and writers used to do them. That.
You know, the Texas writer when we were publishing Revis's series, he has a whole speculative supernatural bent in his books. So it's, you know, it's been coming on. I think at the moment it may be more female driven, or at least I'm not sure. Maybe it's divided, but there are men doing, you know, different, but sort of similar stuff and all there. So, and you've given me a wonderful handle because I'm talking to Alice Hoffman on Sunday, who's sort of the classic of magic, you know, practical magic, all the rest of it. And I appreciate your comments there. About you're right that magical realism does mean that the characters really kind of accept it as ordinary rather than extraordinary.
And, but it's different from fantasy. Yeah. In fantasy, there's more. Whereas in magical realism, it's almost like a bent of the light, a way something shifts, a way somebody acts. Like maybe, like in the House of the Spirits, Clara's older sister has green hair, and that's just it. she, you know, and it's stuff like that. I love it. I would one day love to write it. I don't think it would be able to escape a little touch of horror though, because I am me.
Don't you find too that with magical realism, there is a socio-political overlay sometimes to it?
There often is, because I've read a lot of critical theory about magical realism that posits that in order for a work to truly be magical realism, it must grapple with the socio-political, and it must, it is the voice of the subaltern because it's overturning reality in a way. And so, like, for example, 100 Years of Solitude, Gabriel Garcia Marquez is critiquing resource exploitation in Colombia by American companies. And in The House of the Spirits, there's, at the very end, there's the coup that overthrew Salvador Allende, who was Isabel Allende's relative, and then incoming Pinochet. And so it grappled with fascism. So yes, I would say yes. I think publishers tend to use magical realism a little more.
It's kind of a stereotype in a way. You know, anybody who's kind of a Latina writer is expected.
That would be because of the Latin American boom. Oh yes, the Latin American boom, definitely. You know, I was afraid to write in a mode that was even similar to magical realism, because I thought, oh, they're just going to typecast me across the board. And indeed, people have called the Hacienda magical realism. Whereas Barbara, I don't know if you recall, but when we chatted with Jane Ann Krentz and J.T. Ellison last year, we talked about how the Hacienda is, you know, gothic to the bone. You know, there is not an ounce of magical realism in the Hacienda. There is magic, but those are elements of witchcraft. And so it's horror. So it's a tricky label. And I think publishers like to use it because it's it communicates something about the author rather than about the book. So it kind of communicates more. And this is not all publishers, certainly, but I think when the term gets used lazily, it's like, aha, this is a Latin American author. You can tick off your Latinx Heritage Month bingo with this book, you know? Or it is, you know, it signals this has some elements of non-realism. Take it or leave it. So. Well,
I think your book, you know, if there were an issue that you were, there are issues, but, you know, I think colonialism is a big issue. And this is just like an Alice's book. She's really writing about abortion or anti-abortion and women's need to control their bodies in a very interesting way. And, you know, I think you're right. There has to be at the heart of the book. But that's true of crime novels in general. I mean, really great crime novels, you know, there's always some kind of, you know, what's the word I want, Patrick? You know, not issues, but, you know, an ethical or, you know, some sort of moral underpinning or whatever you want to call it, that otherwise the book is just fraught, you know, and
yeah,
and it should really not just be a pleasure to read, but it should also excite you to think.
Yes, I believe that about horror as well. And I think part of the reason the new crop of horror writers are so exciting to readers is because these authors do that. Whereas, you know, you can pick up some horror novels that are, you know, spooks and thrills and send chills up your spine at night or keep you wanting to keep the lights on. But, you know, like you said, Barbara, they're a little frothy, a little, not slapstick, but, you know, a little gratuitous. Because what is the point of a horror novel what is the point of any novel if it doesn't make you really think about your place in the world and the world around you and other people's places in the world? So I love doing that with my horror. I think, I don't know if I've tried writing horror that doesn't have that underpinning, that kind of, I hesitate to say deeper meaning because it sounds so like high school English class, but that that core of rebellion, or that core of asking both myself as a writer and the reader to think critically about the world we live in. And I failed. So we have Vampires of El Norte that uses a pretty unsubtle analogy or metaphor, I guess, to talk about colonialism.
Well, you know, when I started it, I actually, because I, you know, started without looking at all the publisher stuff, I wondered if in fact the vampires were really just the invading Anglos. And, you know, because you could make a case for that. And one of, I mentioned Alice and the idea of women being able to make choices and control their own bodies and all. Nina is faced with a family that, you know, is going to use her as a bargaining chip. You know, they're going to marry her off to somebody who may help her family beat the drugs. Sorry, yeah. That's my own personal horror has just arrived. 1 minute. I'm sorry, that's the puppies. They just came in and they'll go out in a minute. Right. But, you know, I wondered if in fact the vampires wasn't really going to be, you know, monsters, but were in fact going to be the Anglos, because we're in the 1840s in the Rio Grande Valley, and we're going to have the Mexican War of Independence coming right up here. And, you know, Nina has to try to navigate her own family, as well as the historical events that are coming up on them. And of course, we have the advantage of readers of knowing what's coming, but the characters don't know that there, you know, is going to be a war on their doorstep before.
And I think, so actually, I'll tell you a little bit about the origin of my vampires, because when I was first starting, when this book was first starting to take shape, I went to my mom's house just to visit her in Chicago. And she grew up in the Valley, in the Rio Grande Valley, and has all of these books about Mexican history, Mexican culture on the border, Texas history, etc. And I was kind of just like combing through her books, just kind of, you know, shopping a little bit, as I tend to do at my mom's, and like walk home with some things that definitely don't belong to me. But I found this one book that was unrelated. It was about architecture, I think. But I found a quote by a Texan Tejano politician from the 1850s, a man who was a rancher in South Texas during the time that Vampires of El Norte takes place, and who later worked against when the Rio Grande Valley then became a part of Texas. I was very vocal in his resistance to the invading forces, and who now, I guess, ruled his home. And his name was Cheno Cortina. And in 1859, he wrote this passionate letter to Mexican citizens of the state of Texas and published it in a newspaper. And in it, he wrote about the Anglos who were coming and often by very nefarious and sometimes criminal means, taking land from the Mexicans who had been ranching there for hundreds of years. He called them, he said, vampires came in the guise of men and scattered themselves among the settlements because they were excited by your industry and the avarice which drove them, led them to like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he said vampires. And Barbara, I was worried that by including vampires in this novel, I was kind of shoehorning in this speculative horror element into a historical novel. And when I read that, my jaw hit the floor, because Carmilla and Dracula were published at the end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Karl Marx and Engels did not describe capital as the vampire or the land-owning class as the vampire until later in the century. And he was writing in 1859. In the Rio Grande Valley, like, and he chose the phrase vampires to describe these invaders. And for me, that's when the book really started to click. I knew I had the option of making the, and it did occur to me in the, like, in the back of my mind to make the invading Anglos the vampires. But I think, I don't know, I just kind of followed my gut, and my gut wanted something monstrous. I didn't want the infected, I guess you call it vampiric infection literary trope, which is like the classic, like, oh, you get bitten by the vampire and then you turn into a vampire and then it carries on from there. I decided early on that I didn't want that. I wanted something more, I wanted more of a cryptid. I wanted a bit of a creature feature. I wanted this monster that prowled in the dark. And so I went there, but it did. I'm excited to hear that occurred to you when you started reading the novel, Barbara, because that is exactly what politicians, you know, Cheno Cortina was called the Rio Grande Robin Hood, because he was a bit of an outlaw as well as a politician and a rancher. And the same analogy occurred to him was to call them vampires because of how plainly their, resource exploitation and theft of land was. So
when did like the Lamia come out? And I know I just looked up on my phone at Polidori, you know, he had that.
Polidori was slightly earlier.
Polidori 1819, according to Wikipedia.
So early. But would this man have been reading that? Is the thing that just bothered me. You know? Because I like as a
it was popular, but it's hard to say.
Yeah, as a doctoral student, I wrote about popular literature. And part of the questions I asked of myself when I was doing my research was, okay, so this man encountered this work of popular literature orally and decided to rewrite it. What were his literary influences? So you have to extrapolate like, okay, well, what was he reading? As an educated man in this period, and the period of my dissertation was 14th century Anatolia, so very far from my books. I had to think about like, what were his cultural influences? What was he studying as he grew up? He was a military man. How did that influence, you know, his leisure time? And like, what kind of stories was he hearing on the street from storytellers? And so when I think of Chano Cortina, you know, fighting in the Mexican-American War, being a rancher, being an outlaw, I'm like, was he reading Polidori? Like, I don't know. Was he reading
any? He could have. It's not, you know, improbable.
Or Walpole or some of those others.
Yeah. It's really interesting to think about. Oh, it's so fascinating to me. It makes me want to write a whole other dissertation, but I won't.
But think about that you think about that great flowering of, in the 1880s and 1890s of, you know, of the horror classics.
But they were actually well known in the, you know, the early 19th century. Jane, I'm not sure whether, because I tend to confuse Georgette Heyer and Jane Austen sometimes because I've read them both, but one or the other or both of them talk about Monk Lewis, and you know, he has a seminal work of horror. I often thought of it as more of an Eastern European sort of a thing. I don't know why. And, you know, you've got a rich tradition of speculative and interesting fiction in the Near East, you know, I mean, whether it's Aladdin on his carpet or, you know, or that we have Dracula in, you know, Romania, all the rest of it. Have you ever thought, I'm going to digress here for a second because I'm fascinated with it. Have you thought, since you like writing these kinds of books, that you could actually draw upon your Near East knowledge and write, or do you think you're now forced to be Mexican Gothic?
Publishing likes something that works. And you know, when this works, they're like, well, we've thrown this spaghetti at the wall and it's stuck, let's throw it again. And I'm very happy to write this Gothic pony as long as it'll take me, you know, I specifically Mexican Gothic. I have written short stories and they're available on my website for any listeners who want to read them, isabelcanyes.com. I have my short fiction. I wrote a love story featuring a vampire in 17th century Istanbul. Istanbul is one of my favorite cities in the world. I've spent many happy summers there, some very stressful summers there when there were attempted coups. but I also wrote a short story called A Land of Saints and Monsters, which features the world of my PhD dissertation, basically, with some vampires thrown in. So yes, Barbara, I have. Have I yet been given... I would love to write in this mode at novel length. Will I be given the chance? I guess we'll see.
It's early in your career for you to be thinking about branching out, but keep Stephen King in mind. Or I asked Jim Parker's Orhan Pamuk's book, My Name is Red, is just one of my all-time favorite books.
Oh my God, you're speaking my language. I assigned that novel to my students when I was teaching modern history. And so their assignment was to read My Name is Red and then comment on what aspects of this historical novel rang historically true. And the answer is, of course, an enormous amount of it. Orhan Pamuk is fastidious in his research. He's incredible. But also, it's at its heart, it's a murder mystery. And it's fantastic. It's a great novel. I love that in The Black Book. His novel, The Black Book, is also a bit of a thriller, and it's, the translation's excellent. It's heart-stopping. It's great.
Has anybody written a novel set in those cities that were underneath? I just read a great piece about in Turkey, those hidden, you know, caverns, subterranean cities that were below. Do you know about this at all?
Are you talking about the sort of the hoodoos in Cappadocia?
Maybe so, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think so, at least not in English. I know there's a great, actually a fantastic tradition of historical fiction in Turkish that has gotten super popular lately. So there are lots of very soapy novels because the Turkish soaps, historical soaps have become extremely popular in the last 10 years. So there are lots of novels coming out, very popular pop history, I guess. But also novels set in like the Ottoman Imperial Harem of the 16th and 17th centuries and earlier because of popular TV shows. So that's kind of having a moment. And they're good, but they're frothy, you know? Which for me as a non-native Turkish speaker who studies Turkish and is not like perfect at it is exactly the kind of fare I want and need. But yeah, I don't know to my knowledge if anybody's written in that setting in particular, but if they did, I would love to read it.
I would too. This is actually Women in Translation Month, I just discovered while I was doing a little research. So there's a whole thing going on about, you know, books not written in English and being translated into English and so forth. And so maybe some of this Turkish. Well, I had the good fortune to edit a wonderful historical series set in Justinian's era. So I'm a walking encyclopedia of Byzantine history. Istanbul is one of my favorite cities, and I keep hoping that Erdogan will disappear and, you know, I can feel like I can go back. But we really digress.
From Istanbul to Texas we go.
We could do that, right. So Nina comes from a traditional rancho family, and she and Nestor are childhood sweethearts, whatever. You had to have something to split them up. And I wondered if also you brought in the vampires, the real vampires, to create that instigating incident, because this can't be a second chance romance unless there was a romance and then you blew it away and then there's other opportunities for them to come back together. So did the vampires appear to you to be a useful, you know, mechanism from a craft point in order to achieve that?
They were. And I think, you know, this novel, it broke my back a little bit. I really struggled to write it. I think you speak to so many writers, Barbara. I think you've heard before that the second novel of a writer's career is often way more difficult than the first because the writer is writing under, suddenly we are perceived. Suddenly there is an awareness that people will read this book instead of writing in the dark, as I did with the Hacienda. I wrote it for myself first and foremost. And then when I was writing Vampires of El Norte, suddenly I realized there are people out there who will actually read this, which is a paralyzing thought and very difficult to grapple with. But I say this because I had like six different iterations of Nena and Nestor separating and coming back together and separating and coming back together with different time periods, different things that separated them. I had different speculative elements woven in there. I did have some magical realism to start, but the magical realisms plus the vampires, it's kind of a little murky, speculatively speaking. So I axed the magical realism. And so when it came to using the vampires, they were really the core of this book. And I think it was honestly like the third or fourth draft, which is unusual for me, that they finally crystallized and like their, who they were, and I don't want too many spoilers, but what they are like and how they function in the world, really, I really came to grips with it. And so they did end up separating Nena and Nestor in a particular way. And the two are separated for 9 years. And when they come back together, it's a shock for both of them because Nestor, and this is not too much of a spoiler because I think it's like in the second chapter, Nestor believes that Nena is dead for 9 years. And Nena believes that Nestor has left her. And these are two very different So these two characters had been moving through the world and growing and changing with these with two very different defining beliefs that shape their worldview and how they move through their world. Nestor carries an enormous amount of grief, and Nena does too, but she's also very angry. And when they come back together, sparks flew. Writing these two, Nestor came to me first. He was actually a souvenir from a project that got thrown by the wayside, but he was too good to let go. And my editor actually read that abandoned project, or a synopsis of that abandoned project, and suggested that Nestor become the core of something new. And we were off to the races, baby. And Nena kind of, I guess, was I built her in conversation with him. And so the conversations that these two characters have throughout the book, I had to cut so much because they would not shut up. No, I think it was, there's an enormous amount of banter. And also these characters say very hurtful things to one another. They come from different classes. They've lived very different lives. And they want different things from the world. And Nena, as the daughter of a ranchero, a man who inherited land from somebody who was given it by the Spanish crown. Like, that's a very specific class in this period in history. They're a landowning class. They're a moneyed class. They're the wealth of this area in this time period. And Nestor is a vaquero. He's a cowboy. He works the horses. He works the cattle. And it's a very different life. And so it's kind of like an upstairs, downstairs romance going on. So they talk a lot about class. And when, the ranchero, or the man who owns the rancho, pays his workers, how much does he pay them? And is it fair? And who owns what? And who gets to own what are things that they talk about. And it was a delight to write when it was working. And usually when it was working was when these two characters were talking to one another. They really came to life.
And all that, you had to put it together with real history. Yeah. And, the thing is that the advantage that Nana's family has, somebody wants to take it away from them and become the moneyed class themselves. So who was it I was having, Mark Pryor, on Saturday, Patrick? We had a long discussion over drinks, not during his event, about, the British, they just can't get away from class. And Americans rarely can get away from race. But in your book, they're both together there because, the Anglos in part who want to take, the property and become that class, there's also racism involved in that.
There is.
Texas has never really come to terms with all of it, in my opinion, and we're seeing it going around right now.
It's very hard to watch the news or to consume news about the border right now for me personally, but I agree. I think there's a strong tradition of myth making in Texas. And I don't say that necessarily kindly, because there's, I think in the United States writ large, the way we learned about how the West was won in high school, we learned about manifest destiny and, all that stuff, and how the West was won was a white man's enterprise. And, when you read history books, I know I certainly as a teen, the way I learned it was like, well, that land was empty and they just kind of rolled in. And I think a lot of people get taught history that way, and it was certainly not the way it happened. So I think I feel very strongly about, I don't want to say resurrecting, but when you think about the perspectives of the people who lived in this part of the world, my ancestors who lived on this land and suddenly found the border move around them. I get asked as a Latina all the time, like, oh, when did your family come to this country? It's sometimes a well-meaning question and sometimes not. And I never had a good answer because the Cañas part of my family has been in South Texas for longer than anyone can remember, like minimum 5 generations. So, when did this country come to us is, I think, the correct question that Vampires of El Norte answers with a speculative spin.
But of course, if we wanted to drill down farther, it didn't belong to your ancestors, your Hispanic ancestors either, because they took it away. I mean, they're not called conquistadores for nothing.
Exactly.
I have spent a lot of time in Peru, and really, you know, I mean, there was tremendous infighting among, you know, the indigenous, well, there are layers of indigenous people. I mean, they still are divided by language in Peru. You know, some of them speak Spanish, some of them speak, what's it called? Ayahuasca, something of the sort, you know, some of them speak, I mean, there was always somebody that wanted to take something from somebody.
Exactly. So the Hacienda deals with the question of casta and one's caste. That's what casta means in English. So there are characters who are peninsular, who are Creole, who are white Spaniards born in the Americas, who are mixed, who are mestizo, and who are indigenous. And I talk about it less upfront in Vampires of El Norte, but there's also that racial element at play when it comes to like the moneyed landed class of Nena's family and Nestor, who is an itinerant vaquero. In my research, which I tried not to burden the book with too much, you know, as a writer of historical fiction, I think it is seriously a skill. The restraint required is a serious skill because we learn so much about the period and we want to put it all on the page. But one thing I learned was that vaqueros like Nestor were descended from men and women who had come, who were of a more fully indigenous background, who came from central and southern Mexico north because they were promised work. And so there is a racial element at play as well. Like, who has the land? The Spaniards who were given it by the Spanish crown, the Creoles who were given it by the Spanish crown. Who are the workers? They people of more indigenous backgrounds who came from farther south. Now, I could have, there's so much to juggle in this book and I did want to push more, but you know, restraint, the novel had to be however many pages and not be a dissertation. So that element is at play there, but it is more embedded in social class. And the conversations are more about class and land ownership and money and stuff like that, and less about race between Nena and Nestor. But it's writing about colonial Mexico and independent Mexico is in the 19th century is, there's so many elements at play because you consider race, you consider class, you consider colorism, you consider language, cultural background. There are many different aspects to pick apart that I find really fascinating as a writer. And I think I this is a bit of a secret, but I do plan to continue working with colonial Mexico moving forward because I think there is so much more to be explored.
Really is. You know, at some point you might want to look, what are they called, Patrick, in New Mexico? The conversos. Which I think are really fascinating, except my husband is Jewish. And I came to the conversos. Do you remember, Patrick, we had a conversation about that with some author at the store, but I can't remember who it was. But basically, these were Jews who had settled in Latin America, and then the Inquisition drove them north. And many of them settled in New Mexico, where they kept up some of their Jewish traditions, but they don't know why. They don't know why they have Friday night special meals and so forth. And so when it was revealed to them that they came from, that particular background, has been a real surprise.
Sephardic Jews?
They probably were from Spain. Rather than, they weren't Ashkenazi from Northern Europe, they would have been Sephardic. And they came to Latin America, but then the Inquisition also came to Latin America.
It was indeed
just as ferocious in Latin America as it was in Europe. And so the Jews fled north. But what's interesting is that when they resettled in the north, gradually they forgot their religious cultural tradition, and they kind of settled in to what became New Mexico in particular, you know, is very Hispanic still, you know. And so I find that really fascinating, you know, what happened to the people that were driven out, you know, or exiled And yeah. did they feel like Mexico was their homeland because they'd already been away from Spain for so long? So did they feel that, you know, they were driven out of Mexico, expelled, so to speak? And, you know, what happens there when you become kind of rootless?
Exactly. It's so interesting. And I think what you've just said, it so much describes the experience of being raised Latino in the United States, because their levels of cultural erasure and assimilation and forgetting, and yet you are what you are, and there's you feel like, what is home? Have we been exiled? Have we been driven out? Why have we moved? You know, there's so many aspects of this to pick apart that I think it just makes me tick as a writer. It's fascinating.
But we could also talk about the Cherokee, who were exiled from North Carolina and had to, you know, resettled in Oklahoma. And all of a sudden the federal, you know, the whatever judge it is has made some rulings that separate them from the rest of Oklahoma again in a legal way and other things. But yeah. they were dispossessed. And it was a colonial experience for them too. They were driven away from, you know, the Smokies. Yeah. All the way out to Oklahoma. Ironically, they wound up settling on the oil fields. So it turned out, you know, if you survived it all. You know, so much of our life experience just depends on when we were born, right?
Yeah,
if you were a lucky Cherokee who wound up, you know, with owning like serious oil land, the fact that your ancestors went through all that horrible grief, you know, in order for you to then gain economic power. How do we deal with all of that? I mean, I find it completely fascinating. I also think that people going to like ancestry.com and finding out what their actual heritage is has probably been a real surprise to a lot of people.
I know it is pretty interesting. I think it. I have had some friends who have discovered like more immediately than like a distant relative or a distant heritage that they were unaware of, more like their parents are not their biological parents, or one parent is not their biological parent. Like I have a friend from high school for whom it absolutely blew up, and that's a story waiting to happen.
My point is that we are more mongrel than we might, you know, you want to use that word. We are more mixed, more mixed blood, more mixed, whatever it is, many of us than we think we are.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe the only way to overcome an awful lot of this is for a lot more in the way of mixed marriage and, you know, as we all sort of move towards. Well, we had a really interesting discussion with James Rollins last night about the fact that the people who thought civilization came out of Africa or humans came out of Africa and all, now they've decided that probably isn't the case. They're probably Aboriginal from Australia, which is, you know, like, so much older. So a lot of what we think we know may not be what actually is true. And
yeah.
We're discovering that all the time.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of like part of the thrust behind Vampires of El Norte is like, yeah, you thought you knew the history of Texas. Here's another facet of that extremely imperfect gem. You know, here's another, let's see what happens if the light hits it this way. Like, let's look at a different angle, because I think like a lot of readers aren't familiar with the experiences or perspectives of the people on whom my characters are based. So I think, you know, one thing that I grapple with as a writer of historical fiction is sometimes my work and the work of writers of color gets talked about in a certain way that is like the tool for education. Like, what do we learn from this text about, you know, what certain people believe? And I've been an educator in my life. I taught at the University of Chicago, you know, a small podunk university in Illinois. And I often, and so I think of myself now as a storyteller more than as an educator. And so I feel really strongly that writers of historical fiction should not have, I guess you could say, a pedagogical burden. But I think I tell a story with history as a backdrop. But I do want you to think about things differently. So I think I go back and forth about this, because it's like, I'm not an educator, but I'm showing And I'm bringing forth like a new, what is to many readers, a new world, new perspectives, new ways of thinking about history that to them was familiar or unfamiliar. I don't know. That is Vampires of El Norte. It's the Texas you never knew, you never knew.
So it's not ethnography for the gringos, is what you're saying.
You know, I wasn't going to say it so bluntly, but thank you, Patrick. That is exactly what I was trying to say.
There is this kind of paternalistic kind of, you know, layer that I can see would come into play.
Yeah, like, it's not Next Heritage Month. What do, Mexican-American novelists have to tell us about what the Mexicans think? Like,
exactly,
I can write about
that. You're really interested in that for many cultures. You know, think about the authors that you really love. James Lee Burke, you know, Walter Mosley, Gabino Iglesias, relatively new. You like authors who are showing us the world in different ways, which I think, you know, is a wonderful thing.
I'm thrilled that publishing is making
a reason to read. I think a lot of publishing is having trouble keeping its feet while all this is going on. And my fear is that because publishing likes to follow trends and likes the familiar, whatever it is they have a tendency to oversaturate everything. Mm. So it can eventually turn people away because they think, oh, not another. You know, it was true, you know, I mean, after the Da Vinci Code, I thought if I have to read one more Da Vinci clone, if I have to read one more religious conspiracy thriller, gag. And so I don't want them to play all these cards so heavily that people feel like it's going to be didactic to read these books and they're going to, you know, move in another direction. So, but we can't personally reform publishing, although I'm giving it my best shot, I suppose, Patrick. So why don't we see, Patrick, there are questions from the audience. Isabel, I have to tell you that most of the time the audience comes to these programs in their own time, which is why we don't do tickets, because we don't want people to feel like, you know, if they couldn't make it at 5 o'clock, they can't ever watch it.
I totally understand. Yeah.
One question that's come up, let's see. Do you have any book recommendations for those interested in learning more about Mexican history?
Ooh. Well, what period of Mexican history is the great question. It's the real question here. If you're interested more in the history of the world in which Vampires of El Norte in particular is set, I would recommend some texts that I've mentioned in the author's note of the novel. So there's a book called Tejano Empire, Life on the South Texas Ranchos by Andres Tijerina. And that's kind of more of a daily life of vaqueros in the late 19th, early 20th century in South Texas. I found it fascinating. And as a writer of historical fiction, it blew my mind. I was so excited to find it. The work of Andres Tijerina in particular was fantastic because As a writer of historical fiction, what you're looking for in a history book is not like the top level political history, although sometimes that can be informative of the bigger pieces of the novel. But what you really want is, you know, what people wore, what did they eat? What did their daily lives look like? Like what time did they wake up in the morning and did they feed the chickens or did they feed hogs? And what did they have for breakfast? And was coffee common yet? Because I certainly drink a lot of coffee and I would like my characters to as well, you know, stuff like that. And so that book was very informative. I think if we were to give something a little broader, because I have some texts about curanderismo, which is a bit more specific.
Who Glows in the Dark. What a great title.
Yeah, isn't it? It's an incredible book. It is an incredible book by Elena Avila. Text that I found fascinating for writing this book and that was deeply informative, especially on earlier drafts, was a book called Caballero by Jovita Gonzalez, who was a Texan folklorist from the mid 20th century. The book was published posthumously and also with a co-author, because as a Mexican woman, she co-wrote the book with a white woman in order, an Anglo woman, to try and get the book published. It was never picked up by publishers in New York. But she wrote the book was called Caballero, and her works that I've listed in the author's note are folk stories and tall tales that circulated among people who lived on the ranches in South Texas and in small towns in South Texas that if you read them, you'll see many Easter eggs in Vampires of El Norte. Because one thing that I ended up playing with when I wrote this book was storytelling and folklore. Because when I think about my own family history, there's so many stories. My mother-in-law has gone on like a big bender of genealogy and ancestry.com, like you mentioned, Barbara, where she has found documents in Scotland from family members of theirs dating back to like the early 18th century. And what do I have? She asked me like, what do you have to contribute to this project? Because you're part of the family now. And I was like, stories, you know, like, oh yeah, my great grandmother saw Pancho Villa ride through her village. So did half of northern Mexico, it seems, because everybody's great-grandmother seems to have this story. But stories are my inheritance, and they're very powerful and meaningful to me. So the characters in this book tell stories to each other. They're vaquero tall tales. They definitely have that Paul Bunyan vibe to them. But they shaped the novel in ways that I didn't expect. So the folklore, I guess that doesn't answer the question, like, history of Mexico. It's like, well, let's talk about folklore. This is me, my popular literature background coming through.
You have a very complete, you have a lot of sources listed on page 367 in the author's note. And I always recommend to readers of historical fiction that you look for the author's note. Acknowledgements can be that way. And oftentimes the author on the author's website will list sources and so forth that maybe don't, you know, there's not room in the novel or you're updating it or something. So that's an
option. I have a 4-month-old, so updating my website is not like at the top of my list of priorities on a day-to-day basis, but I would love to do that in the future, is add sources, because I got a lot. There's a lot more where that came from. She's the tip of the iceberg, the author's note.
Yeah. Did you ever come across a book called A Vaquero of the Brush Country by J. Frank Dobie?
No. Oh, Dobie is a very famous folklorist. So I have read some of Dobie's other work, but not that particular one. Dobie was a teacher of Jovita Gonzalez. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So she studied with him, I think. Did he teach at UT? I believe it was UT, UT Austin. But he was kind of like the grandfather of folklore studies.
Interesting. Wasn't there a heavy German population in that area too?
Yeah, in Fredericksburg.
Yeah, there is. I don't
know. Fredericksburg actually looks Bavarian. I've only been there once, but Linda Castillo has moved to Fredericksburg because it's a good place for her horses.
I love the banda music. You know, it's just interesting.
I was going to say influences
hybrid of like boom papa. You know, very German and like
polka almost.
Totally. You know? Yeah. With. Yeah. Very traditional German instruments. And
banda music is having a resurgence. The kids are all about it. Like regional Mexican is having a huge moment. And I'm like, that is my grandfather's music. It's so strange. But, you know, knock yourselves out. It's great. I listen to it.
There's a question from Daniela. She says, at some point, do you think you'll write stories in other periods of Mexican history, such as the conquest by Spain?
That would be fun. I think it would be a lot of research, which of course is exactly my cup of tea. So I have considered it. I have also considered, but I think I would take a speculative bent to it, of course. So I don't know what that would end up looking like, but I have considered it. Another period I've considered looking at is the Mexican Revolution of 1910 to 1920. Because the Mexican Revolution is in part why my great-grandmother moved to Texas from Nuevo León. And it was a civil, in the north of Mexico, which is where my family is from, and South Texas, the Mexican Revolution was a civil conflict that had, it was very up close and personal for many people. It wasn't like we're having a battle here. It was very messy and sprawling. And a lot of people encountered violence very up close and personal who were not in any way connected to like Pancho Villa, just like your average villagers dealt with it very close up. A lot of people fled, a lot of people hunkered down. It's a very interesting period of history for me when I think about the movement of people and why, you know, members of my family ended up where they ended up. So I would love to write something set in Monterrey in the 1920s. So we'll see what happens. But I do have a project in mind that I would love to write. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
How about a B. Traven novel? Wouldn't that be fun?
A what?
B. Traven, you know, who wrote the Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And then
disappeared.
Yeah, B. Traven, this sort of mythical figure. Fascinating. That whole time period, though, is so interesting.
Yeah, a lot of people have written about the Mexican Revolution. So part of me feels like I'm wading into something that's been done before. But I bring a speculative bent to whatever period of history I tackle. So it'll be something fresh.
That'd be cool. Yeah. Let's see here. We could nerd out about books about that period, by the way. There's such a huge body of literature about the revolution, and John Reed's Insurgent Mexico is a big favorite of mine. Let's see here.
We haven't even mentioned the work of Paco Taibo, which is not them. Yeah. You know, a lot of interesting stuff. Have you run across Paco Taibo?
I have not read his work.
Ah, we might have one or two that I can send you because they're hard to find, but he's an amazing, amazing Mexican writer.
Yeah.
Patrick and I are very fond of his work.
Absolutely.
Which reads so little time, especially now that I'm a mother.
Right. I think that's about it as far as actual questions.
Alrighty. Well, we have been all over the place, possibly digressing more than usual in this conversation, but then why not? Because we have established that this is indeed a genre bending, you know, novel that incorporates all kinds of fascinating stuff from history and romance to vampires and horror. And
Feel the lightning bolt kind of crash.
Yes, no, it really is. It's a very electric, electrifying image. And
it has a 1920s vibe to it too, the whole palette of it.
Yeah.
The colors are so striking. When this dropped in my inbox, I was like, that's it. Done. Bought, sold, paid for.
Well, I thought the Hacienda was amazing. Yeah, now I've read this one. I also think it's amazing. So Isabel is only on book two. So I recommend for those of you who are at many events say, where shall I start? And I start with the Hacienda and then move to this one. They are completely different stories. You do not have to read the Hacienda to make any sense of it. But why not read both? The Hacienda publishes in paperback on September 26th, so it'll be available for you very shortly. It's an amazing story. It's kind of a speculative fiction, Agatha Christie, gothic, whatever set in Mexico.
It's also, the ebook is also currently on sale, and it will be on August 25th. So that's my little plug for the Hacienda ebook. If you read ebooks,
why not? And there's probably an audiobook as well. Is there?
There is, and it's the actors swing for the fences, and it's incredible. They are so good. I had the pleasure of picking them out, and I not to toot my own horn, but I picked pretty well. They really performed the heck out of it. I highly recommend the audio.
That's great. You can experience the story in various formats. You can read it, you can listen to it, you can whatever, and maybe one day there'll be a movie. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Not during the writer's strike, but, you know,
After.
Right. So don't forget, we have autographed copies still to go for this wonderful book. And if you're really interested in pursuing magical realism and all, join us at the bookstore on Sunday at 4 o'clock when Alice Hoffman, who has written lots of wonderful books, Practical Magic may be the most well-known, but I thought The Dove Keeper is her historical novel about Masada and the women of Masada just stopped my heart. So there you go. Anyway, good night, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Isabel, a real pleasure. Good night.
Thank you so much. Bye, guys.
Congrats.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.